Let's do the 60-second savings challenge. Step one, download Rocket Money. Step two, link your accounts and see every subscription you're paying for. Tap one you don't use and cancel it. That's money back every month. Step three, create a financial goal. $50 every paycheck. Or let the app automatically move small amounts of cash when you can afford it. In a week, you'll forget you set it up. In a month, you'll see real dollars piling up. In a year, you'll be shocked at how much money you've saved. Bonus challenge. Upload an internet or phone bill and let Rocket Money try to lower it. You only pay if they find you savings. On average, Rocket Money members can save up to $740 a year when using all of the app's premium features. Users love the app with over 186,000 five-star ratings. Make saving money the resolution you actually keep. Start the 60-second savings challenge at rocketmoney.com/cancel. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Planet Fitness has everything you need to get stronger just around the corner, so you can give everything you've got. Whether you want to crush a few reps before class with our expanded strength equipment or sweat it out on your way home from work, with over 2,800 locations, there's a Planet Fitness close to you, and most are open 24 hours. Join the club today and save $28 or more when you join for $1 down, $15 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends January 30th. Are you coming? Planet Fitness. We're all strong on this planet. See club for details.
Page 94, the Private Eye Podcast.
Hello and welcome to another episode of Page 94. My name's Andrew Hunter-Murray and I'm here in the Eye Studio with Helen Lewis, Adam McQueen and Ian Hislop. Today we are asking the most important question in world politics. Who is Andy Burnham and what does he want?
And how can he be stopped
by the NEC?
Well, I should explain exactly why we're talking about this now, because at time of writing, he's been banned by Keir Starmer and the Labour NEC from standing as an MP. He's currently Mayor of Greater Manchester and he would have to resign from that post in order to do it. Now, I would say we did have a number crunch in the last issue, which was the number of U-turns by Keir Starmer. Up until going to press, and we did have to change that several times in the course of the week as we were putting the pages together. But that's currently the situation. So yeah, Andy Burnham, Mayor of Greater Manchester. I mean, incredible poll numbers. Elected three times as Mayor of Manchester. He got 63.4% in 2017, 67.3% in 2021. It's going up. It's quite a rarity that the incumbent goes up. And then 63.4% again in May 2024, last time he stood. So you can kind of see why people are thinking, ooh, someone who actually the public seem to like and who might actually win some votes might be a good thing for the Labour Party.
Has he been effective? Has he done a good job in Manchester?
I tried to work out what the best measure of this was. And I looked in the Private Eye archive. He's barely appeared in rotten boroughs in all of his time in charge of Greater Manchester. So I think that does give you a level of He's been pretty good.
So when this by-election was announced, he suggested he would like to stand for the seat. He has been blocked from standing by the sort of high command council, the Jedi Council of the Labour Party, by a thumping majority of about 8-1. Mm-hmm. So as I understand it, their reasoning. And I know there are other reasons apart from what they suggested, but their reasoning was, you've just been elected, or recently been elected, Mayor of Greater Manchester. If we let you stand in this by-election to become an MP again, we'll have to have another election in Greater Manchester. That seems like a bad use of party resources.
There's one thing they're not keen on. They don't like having local elections if they can possibly get away with it.
Right. But if he left the Greater Manchester mayoralty, they'd probably lose that.
Yes. The argument that, reform will win a significant victory. Will they win either way? Don't they? I hate to sound as though I think Keir Starmer might have been right, but he's done 2 years, has he, as mayor? He's got another due to go. Why not finish the term? Mm. Why not indicate that Labour's there for the long term? It can stick to what it says it's going to do, rather than a man saying, oh, look, it's a chance for me to be leader. I mean, the whole shtick of the Labour Party was these terrible Tories, they change their leader every 5 minutes. Why can't they grow up? Mm. They all said psychodrama a lot. That was written into all Labour speeches, all Tory psychodrama. And what have we got? We've got a Labour psychodrama with Burnham just turning up. I looked at a previous cover. I mean, we had Andy Burnham saying, I'd like to lead the Labour Party, and Keir Starmer saying, so would I. I mean, give him a chance. But we have done this a lot, haven't we?
Yeah, in a very real sense, Andy Burnham has been running to be Labour leader since at least 2010. That was his first crack at it, right?
When he's done it officially twice, 2010 and 2015. And then he ran again, and lost.
He lost to Ed Miliband and he lost to Jeremy Corbyn. I remember I went to the first Labour Party conference after the pandemic, the one they had in person, so 2021. I was on a panel about devolution with him. And he was late because he was being stopped for autographs and selfies because at the time Keir Starmer was in trouble and he was peacocking around and kind of going, do you know who else is available? Me, Andy Burnham. And he'd got his little uniforms, he's got these little polo shirts, this little Fred Perry polo shirts and stuff. And then he did exactly the same at last year's party conference. He gave a big interview to the New Statesman in which he said, I don't really agree with the financial markets dictating our policy. I don't know what that's all about, which spooked the market. And then it was quite a deal of, for all that there are some people who really, really love him, there are also quite a lot of people who think, cool, give over. Can I, you know, what's that great line that I always think of from Mr. Bennett? Let the other young ladies have a chance to exhibit. You know, you have been doing this now for 16 years, Andy.
I think there is a really strong feeling in the Labour Party and in the country now that sort of anyone but Keir would be better. And there's an argument possibly to be made for that.
Maybe even a woman, Adam, for the first time in 116 years.
Labour have never been terribly keen on, have they? No. Might be better.
Didn't Keir have the choice this time of the newspapers and the media saying, oh, you're so pathetic, you're going to let him run? Or, oh, you're so pathetic, you've stopped him. Yeah, you're pathetic, Keir. Yeah. Either way, it didn't really matter which way he went, did it? The narrative is still, you're useless.
I think the thing it reveals to me, and this is very nerdy, I'm sorry, is that one of the key things if you want to run the Labour Party is you've got to have control of the National Executive Committee, which sounds extraordinarily boring, but is extraordinarily true. Corbyn never really got a grip on the party until he had installed Carrie Murphy, his choice, to run the party. Same thing happened with Starmer. He had to get his own person in control before he could, because then you get a huge amount of control over, for example, selections, right? So there is the way you're right that the Tories have this kind of regicidal appetite. The way to win in Labour is just to kind of seize control of the bureaucracy and just like hold it in a vice-like grip and thereby see off all your opponents through grinding procedural motions.
And that's what Keir Starmer's been really good at, isn't it? Yeah, it's absolute control of the party. Which is it was kind of what they felt they needed after the chaos of the Corbyn years, I guess. But
Do you have a prediction? Will this work?
I don't think he's going to be allowed to stand this time around. I mean, he's going to be he's the king across the water, isn't he? Whatever happens, he's going to go. This term runs through till 2028. We'll probably have got through several other prime ministers by then, won't we? But I mean, he clearly is coming back for another. I mean, there is no pretense about this. He is not pretending anything other than that he wants to take over the leadership of the Labour Party. He wrote the week before he announced he was standing for the by-election, a piece for The Guardian about it was basically his kind of political philosophy, which turns out to be Manchesterism.
Yes,
which means not taking a coat off and going down the hacienda. No, it doesn't. Sorry. he made the point about the various things he has done for Manchester. They brought the bus and tram system back into public control, which is a big problem anywhere outside of London because privatisation meant that everything is disconnected and run for profit or run down completely. He's been brilliant on the Hillsborough, campaigning on behalf of the Hillsborough families and pushing for the Hillsborough law, which incidentally was Keir Starmer U-turn number 14, one of the ones we had to update last week. He swerved very cleverly the Corbyn years by standing as he did actually serve under Corbyn. He was first shadow Home Secretary under Corbyn and then 2017 left Parliament to stand for Manchester Mayor. But ever since then, he's kind of defined himself against Westminster. This is him in a 2019 interview. He said, Westminster is a bizarre place with a deeply dysfunctional atmosphere. I don't miss it in the slightest. It's just poisonous now. Try it 6 years on from that. And then last week in The Guardian, he kicked off by having a pop at Reform and saying, all these Tories coming up to him. It's hardly the stuff of a political insurgency. Suddenly, Britain's newest political force doesn't look quite so potent or relevant. Instead, it seems old. Says cabinet minister from 2007. So they're not, neither of these from Andy Burnham are brilliant arguments for bringing him back into Westminster and becoming leader.
I like the fact that he's named this movement Manchesterism as opposed to Burnhamism, which is what he means. It's a sort of faux modesty, isn't it?
There's surely a lot of advantage to be made about being anti-Westminster at the moment. I mean, the number of... That's Reform's whole pitch as well, isn't it?
There absolutely is, but then it does get difficult when you get into Westminster, doesn't
yes.
it?
And also,
Reform's thing at the moment is saying, well, we're no good at it, so we're just going to get in loads and loads of Tories. I mean, as we write, Suella Braverman has just defected to Reform. She's the latest one. Which does actually now mean they've got more Reform MPs who used to be Tory MPs than they've got of their own now, doesn't it?
Yep. And it's now a party full of people who the electorate rejected last time, which, again, may not be promising. And Suella Braverman, I mean, she hesitated for so long. I assume she thought that Reform weren't right-wing enough and she's just waiting. But now seems to be the moment.
It is a bit weird recording this podcast 2 weeks after we had a big discussion about ICE having just killed a civilian with no justification, and Nadeem Zahawi just having defected to Reform. I mean,
it's a repeat.
Yeah.
Stuck forever.
It's Andrew Rossendale I feel sorry for. I mean, there's no impact whatsoever. 2 days after...
I'm just going to say on behalf of lots of listeners, who?
Yes, well, exactly. He was the one who went 2 days after Robert Jenrick and said, by the way, I'm defecting to Reform as well. And everyone did go, who? What?
Yeah, but for a long time, he wasn't allowed on the Commons estate while various allegations were investigated. So he may not have had the chance to make the biggest impact. Mm. Did you watch the Robert Jenrick, Nigel Farage press conference? I did on holiday.
You know how to have fun.
No, the best thing was Nigel Farage saying, the door is closing on May the 5th, right? You like act now to secure your place in Reform. Like, I won't let any of you jump. Right, you know, the rats must leave the sinking ship now.
I get this with Instagram adverts all the time, though. You know, we're having our last ever closing down sale of 50% off. It never is.
No.
It never is.
It was just a truly bizarre... Both of them sat there behind that little table as various journalists read out disobliging quotes they'd said about each other, and they went, when I said he was a twat, I meant in a sort of jokey way.
Well, I like the sort of shame confessional that Nigel will now make you read out if you do defect. You have to say, Robert's very ashamed of having been in the Conservatives, aren't you, Robert? Yes, I am, Nigel, yes. Robert,
and you have to say, Britain is broken.
Britain is broken.
And it's broken partly because I was in government and I broke it, but I have now seen the light.
That's why I'm such
Suella
a huge
Braverman
asset.
Had to say, I now feel at home, as opposed to send everyone else home. I mean, it's just, what are we watching? The Iran cover last time, people were worried that she was about to defect. It was exactly the same sentiment. She said, I'm throwing my hate into the ring. And she's doing it again.
Yeah.
Presumably, I mean, Helen, does Farage think these people are a threat or not?
I think he specifically thinks they're not a threat, which is why he's allowing them to have it. Because I think the bit that he lacks is any organisational infrastructure, right? Like, he needs that mechanics of running things. And also, I think he's genuinely preparing to be Prime Minister next time round. And you might say, Suella Braverman kept getting sacked from the Home Office, but she did, you know, she does have cabinet-level experience. That is true. And, you know, and he really has never had that. But, you know, as we've described on this podcast before, it'd be interesting to see whether or not, you know, they do the full stretch. The bit that fascinated me about that Jenrick press conference was a bit where Robert Jenrick was forced to say, I haven't been promised any kind of job. And I thought, well, if that's true, then you're stupid, so I don't believe you.
Mm. Yeah.
You're really going to hang around and just, you know, having had all this ambition, you surely have got to be thinking, Nigel smokes quite a lot. I'm quite young and on the Ozempic. I can wait this one out. You know?
But I think they're also going to have a problem in that they've got so many people who are going to want the same jobs should they come into government. I mean, Richard Tice has obviously always assumed he's going to be Chancellor. Mm. I think Zia Yusuf kind of thinks he might be Chancellor.
Nadeem Zahawi thinks he's going to be
Chancellor.
Zahawi
definitely thinks he could come back and do it again. Declaring all his tax stuff this time, hopefully.
Yeah. Well, no one's desperately pitching for the Duchy of Lancaster, are they?
You know, no one wants those kind of jobs.
Chancellor.
But even more to the point, it's so top-heavy. I mean, what they really need to have people defecting now is the kind of the practical ground-level stuff. Are they getting the constituency associations and the kind of electoral agents and things? Are they defecting from the Tories? Because that's where you really need the experience on the ground to get people out. You know, it's people who are going to... You don't need a lot of preening ex-cabinet ministers. What you need is a lot of people who are going to go onto doorsteps in the rain and shove in leaflets through people's letterboxes. And
that they probably do have, because their membership, although quite opaque, I think is now bigger than the Tories and bigger even than Labour. But you're right. Those would be the people if I was Nigel Farage, be trying to bring on board, is the constituency chairman and women who are the people who can run a selection process, who can, you know... Yeah, who can
and the
do
most
that
we've heard
stuff.
From them is sort of Jenrick's constituency, people saying we're outraged. He always said he wasn't going to do as he promised to us. So.
They all, when they defect, say, I've always been conservative, it's in my DNA, but as of yesterday, I've noticed I'm going to lose my seat. they all do this big loyalty number. Whereas I think, from my experiences, the people in the constituencies are conservative. And that's why they've pushed leaflets through doors for years. They are more likely to be loyal. So I'll be really interested to see whether that army of people actually do defect.
Because the
sure.
real challenge is going to be getting the vote out in individual constituencies. They've still got, in a first-past-the-post system, a hell of a hill to climb. Well, 320-whatever hills to climb. And that's going to be where the real difficulty for them lies, I think. Can I just give you my top fact about,
Andy
Burnham?
Yeah.
He's an ex-journalist. Very, very briefly... He worked for trade mags, including Tank World, which amazingly isn't as exciting as it sounds.
Tanky World.
Because it is the world's premier bulk liquid transportation publication.
Oh, that kind of tank.
Yeah, that sort of tank.
I'm as interested, I'm afraid.
Let's do the 60-second savings challenge. Step one, download Rocket Money. Step two, link your accounts and see every subscription you're paying for. Tap one you don't use and cancel it. That's money back every month. Step three, create a financial goal. $50 every paycheck. Or let the app automatically move small amounts of cash when you can afford it. In a week, you'll forget you set it up. In a month, you'll see real dollars piling up. In a year, you'll be shocked at how much money you've saved. Bonus challenge. Upload an internet or phone bill and let Rocket Money try to lower it. You only pay if they find you savings. On average, Rocket Money members can save up to $740 a year when using all of the app's premium features. Users love the app with over 186,000 five-star ratings. Make saving money the resolution you actually keep. Start the 60-second savings challenge at rocketmoney.com/cancel. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Donald Trump has finally recommitted to the multilateral process, the rules-based order. He has set up an organization called the Board of Peace. I, for one, can't wait to find out how it's going to work, how much peace it's going to be bringing to the world. Helen, you've been reading a bit more about it, right?
Yes, so much peace. He had the signing, his cousin too, he had the signing ceremony for it at Davos, accompanied by some of the people who have signed up. Now, he has previously said that the United Nations is useless, not least when he appeared at the United Nations, if you remembered, not least that escalator didn't work, which upset him an enormous amount. Mm. So he turned up at Davos and said, well, we might work with it, but this is the kind of new kid in town. So do you want to hear about the rules for the Board of Peace? Okay. anyone can join. I don't think you can join personally, but any country can join for a 3-year term. But if you want to be a permanent member, $1 billion. Guess who the founding director and chair of the Board of Peace is? And indeed, lifetime chair of the Board of Peace.
Yeah. I think I can guess his surname.
It's Donald J. Trump. The only way he can be removed is if he steps down or is voted out by a unanimous vote of the board whom he is appointed.
This is after his presidency ends.
Oh, yeah, no, he gets to keep it after he stopped being president. If he ever stops being president. Yeah.
Is there any suggestion as to where this money is going?
A good, if unanswered, question. So he said it won't be run with like a huge amount of executive bloat. But given that Trump has, and the Trump family generally have a lot of crypto interests, where it's not entirely clear where some of their foreign, you know, trading and stuff like that, where that money ends up, I would love to see a paper trail for where this, if the money ever gets handed. I mean, the whole thing just looked like a sort of weird, not a bit like the sort of sealed knot reenactments of battles. It was like a sort of reenactment of the UN, like a school nativity play version of the UN. I just don't know how real it actually will be. So it started off as a Gaza thing.
Right.
And so there's a couple of different boards. There's the executive board, there's the Gaza executive board, and then there's a board of actual Palestinians who I think are actually going to have to do any hard work.
Because it started, the first we heard about this was Tony Blair was going to sit on it, wasn't
he? He is, yeah. And he's on.
Is he on the main one, or is he on the Gaza one? Or
He's on the executive board, and there was a great moment when
Trump... So has he ponied up $1 billion?
No. No, I don't think even what they call the companies Fire Rush and Wind Rush is his sort of dictator wrangling.
Bums Rush being the main one.
He's sitting on one of the boards as an individual alongside like Steve Witkoff, the Middle East envoy, Jared Kushner, Trump's son-in-law.
The porcelain doll, yes.
Yeah, yes. I mean,
the haunted porcelain doll that is his son-in-law, yes.
Someone needs to have a word with esthetician, I think, about just dialing back the Botox a bit. Then again, not being very easily surprised is probably when you work in the Trump orbit.
Just you don't want to register any emotions.
Yeah. Sounds like a great idea, sir. Let's get on it immediately. Anyway, so that's the personal bit. And there was a great bit in the ceremony when Trump was introducing people. He said, you know, we've got people on the board, some popular, some less popular, he said, looking at Tony Blair. It was quite harsh, I felt. And then he brought them all up to sign. So Javier Milei, his big mulleted friend of
Chainsaw.
Argentina.
Mr. Chainsaw's
on there. Viktor Orban of Hungary, who's a big, you know, Trump lackey, was obviously on
He's
there.
Representing the liberal wing.
Yeah, right.
You say he brought them all up to sign. I mean, actually, two of the members of the Board of Peace couldn't attend because they're under international arrest warrants, aren't they? In the form of Alexander Lukashenko and...
Vladimir Putin has only been invited. He's still quibbling over whether or not he will, in fact, join up or not. I mean,
Benjamin Netanyahu as well has got a bit of bother with the International Criminal Court,
yes,
hasn't he?
Yes, so, bit of a legal issue there. And also, one of Putin's things that he's as ever trolling about is whether or not his billion could come from seized Russian assets. So essentially money he doesn't currently have access to.
Right. And he could use it to pay his entry fee.
Okay, but I'm hearing a lot of scepticism, frankly, guys, and I don't like it. Let's focus on the peace.
Yes.
Because we know Trump's already ended 8 wars. So are there really any more left to end?
Well, a very good point. There was a moment, a particularly haunting moment, when Jared Kushner was brought up to do what I can only describe as, actually, to use your word, a sort of haunted McKinsey keynote Q2 presentation about his plan for Gaza, which was quite heavy on sort of little diagrams about arrows of stuff going to each other. And then there was a plan for what he's going to do to Rafah City. So in Gaza, 80% of the buildings have been destroyed. It's a huge rebuilding project. But it was kind of like, here are some skyscrapers. You know, almost you were expecting to see sort of like little flying cars around the AI-generated images. But that's, you know, that's where some of the money could go. This is a question, like, who's going to pay to rebuild Gaza? Trump keeps saying it should be the surrounding Muslim countries. Obviously, Israel not very keen to pay. Maybe some of this money in the best possible. If I was going to be able to give you the best, most generous assessment, other countries could chip in. But essentially, the point
they could do that anyway.
Yeah, well, right.
They don't have to do it via some fatuous body that Trump has just invented.
Yes, and there are, I would always worry in this situation that he's going to invent like Gaza coin and for everybody to put their money into some sort of special meme coin that for the rebuilding of Gaza, money's later never to be seen again.
I believe that the Board of Peace has been accepted or endorsed somehow by the, is it the UN Security Council?
The UN has got a resolution about the rebuilding of Gaza, which they are working in accordance with, and that's Trump's 20-point plan. But the UN has done kind of what I would sort of expect them to do, which sounds is gone, great, get on with it, lads. Let's all see you in Rafah when it's rebuilt. You crack on.
But it struck me that Trump's initiative to have an alternative UN, like nearly all his decisions, hinges on one moment where he felt slighted. So it's the speech where Obama was mildly rude to him. This is his visit to the UN. And he thinks that the UN slighted him because he said, you're a collection of shithole countries that don't work. I don't know what I'm doing. I could do it much better. And the teleprompter doesn't work. And he's decided to set up an alternative UN. How long this will last is anyone's guess. Well, anyone who guesses less than 5 minutes. But essentially, all he's doing is attempting to replace something he hates with something with him in charge.
Yeah.
That's the modus operandi.
I'm running it kind of like Mar-a-Lago, right? He's running it like a golf club or a private members club, which is you have an entry fee and then you have all these fabulous benefits, which mostly are hanging around with the President of the United States. The interesting thing is, I was surprised, maybe I wasn't surprised, that Viktor Orban signed up to it. I guess a lot of those leaders are thinking, we'll never have to pony up this money. This is he'll have forgotten about it in 10 minutes. It'll be, or we'll say, you know, it's going to be in special bonds or something bollocks like that. But the European Union would just hard no. Like Macron, France, said, we're not joining this. And then he said, Trump said, I'm going to put 200% tariffs on champagne, which was just a kind of great, like, what's the most French thing I can think of? I'm going to tax strikes and yellow vests.
Small moustaches.
And berets. French fries, probably.
Yeah, right.
It's got a history.
And then Mark Carney of Canada gave a very good speech at Davos, which was about what he called the middle powers. He said, you know, we're now entering this era again of the great power rivalry, America, China, Russia. And then where does that leave the second tier countries? And he said, if we're not going to be subservient, we have got to kind of work together. And he talked about the fact that Canada has obviously got, is contributing to the war in Ukraine, for example. And that was the kind of, actually, the one of the most interesting things that might come out of Trump at Davos and the Board of Peace is a kind of, not like a super European Union, but actually the sort of Board of Peace, which will be what I think of as sane countries, basically.
Part of the problem for Trump is that his criticism of the UN was it's sclerotic. Nothing ever happens because you've got all these conflicting voices, like, say, having Russia on the same panel as China or America. And he's replicated that. So how he thinks this is an alternative model in which there will be easily arranged accords between major powers, which will sort everything out. Isn't that what he objected to in the UN?
Well, it seems that a lot of it is government by announcement. Trump is very, very nervous about any kind of sustained military engagement anywhere, clearly, but loves a big raid, strike on somewhere. We've gone in. We've sorted out Venezuela.
We've run out again.
Yeah, exactly that. And this, it seemed a bit like that to me.
I suspect the answer to it will be that there isn't a lot of debate and a lot of voting between different people who disagree on things. So I had a look at the opening charter of the border piece. It says, decisions should be made by a majority of the member states present by voting, subject to the approval of the chairman. So, you know, it's not even like a deciding vote. It's actually like whether he wants it to go ahead or not, isn't it?
I reckon first order of business will be instituting some sort of Board of Peace prize that they can then award to Trump. Maybe that actually may be the plan behind all of it. Yeah, I think that's why I mean about how I don't know how seriously to take it. And the interesting thing is about something about the way that the Trump admin is currently operating is sort of like every unbelievable lib 2004 opinion. So, you know, that kind of Michael Moore strand of the left that said Iraq war is all about oil, and you were kind of, that was supposed to be a very unsophisticated thing to think. And then with Venezuela, they just went, well, of course it's all about oil, isn't it?
Yeah.
And then this presentation for the border piece was essentially a pitching, Steve Witkoff and Jared Kushner pitching to a room full of businessmen, this is, you're going to make a load of money, right? Which is always the criticism of Dick Cheney and Halliburton, that the Iraq war was incredibly good for American military contractors, not so much for the people of Iraq. And then they were just sort of doing this. So it was basically like, you lads can make a load of money running the hotel industry in the newly revitalized Gaza. And just a straightforward, like, this is an investment opportunity for you. Really, really.
And this
odd.
Is meant to be a strength. This is realism, in that all government is essentially financial transaction. Which it clearly isn't. That's one of the few things history teaches.
Financial transactions for the benefit of the Trump organisation as well, isn't it? I mean, what struck me with this is that they're obliged under the terms of this charter to meet at least once a year and on other ad hoc meetings. I mean, those sort of things tend to take place at Mar-a-Lago or, you know, nice Trump golf resorts where suddenly the hotels are sold out and all of the security details have got to be put up and things as well. And the money sort of goes directly back into the commercial interests of the president as well. I mean, that's the one thing that might keep this going, I think.
Yeah, that's why I think my most favoured option for what happens is essentially this is a once-a-year meeting at the Miami Doral Trump golf course. Or maybe what's the Scottish one that he owns?
Turnberry.
Yeah, exactly. We can have a bid for it so that we can have Vladimir Putin come and talk about peace in Turnberry.
Having said that this was going to be an international body that sorted out the problems of the world, he has previously said that there is no such thing as international law. There is only his own morality. He needs no other guide. So the entire world now, according to Donald Trump, only needs his personal set of morals in order to sort itself out.
Yeah, I, for one, feel safer already.
Should we just pretend it's a joke then?
Well, I mean, if it was joking, I mean, if you were writing this up for the joke pages of Private Eye, I mean, once the members of the Board of Peace, would you go as far as Alexander Lukashenko and Milei and Benjamin Netanyahu? I mean, it's quite...
No, I'd add them in for effect afterwards as a sort of exaggerated overstatement.
Yeah, I mean, I think the thing that's interesting about that is that Trump reversed on Greenland. And as ever, it was really the financial markets just turning. That is still a rebuke that he worries about. He did fold on that. Mm. Whereas what's very interesting that's currently also happening, we talked last episode about Minnesota and ICE and Border Patrol.
It is slightly ironic, isn't it, establishing a border peace when you're promulgating civil war at home. I mean, you can't even keep peace in one of your own cities. Mm. Not even trying to keep peace. You're actually destabilising the city in order to create non-peace.
Yeah. I think that's what's happening in Minneapolis, is that these, you know, non-police forces that have been told by Stephen Miller, who is essentially the kind of, I guess you'd call him Trump's prime minister. He hasn't got a very impressive title, but he's essentially running the White House domestically, has said, you know, they've got immunity. You know, our federal agents are doing a really important job cracking down on rapists and domestic abusers. And actually, you know, we shouldn't, you know, no one should be standing in their way of them doing anything. And if they, you know, and if people get killed, then sort of tough luck. And what happened with the latest killing is that the White House came out immediately and just lied, just straight up lied. Kristi Noem of Homeland Security said this guy who was killed was a domestic terrorist who turned up trying to kill ICE agents.
Brandishing the gun.
Yeah.
And attempting to take out several ICE agents.
Yeah.
Which was just so obvious from the footage that wasn't the case. And what was clear from the footage as well was the gun that the guy was carrying had been taken off him at the point before he was shot 10 times. So even under that justification.
The press do seem to be having quite a hard time covering it, certainly in America, as other than anything but a war of words. Oh, well, there seem to be a lot of conflicting narratives about this shooting of a civilian who'd just been disarmed of a gun he appears to have been carrying legally. You know, well, very hard to say who's right here.
Yeah, as opposed to saying, why do you think He was shot then.
Yeah.
And does that matter? I mean, it seems to me the focus on Trump's assault on truth, which he's been doing for a long time, and it is grotesque and really offends people, but it does mask, it creates a huge amount of flack, which I'm sure is deliberate, rather than the event itself, which is an American citizen's been shot dead in a city for doing nothing.
Mm. One aspect which I thought was really interesting was that Trump came out himself and said on Truth Social, well, he was carrying a gun, and you know, anyone who carries a gun to a protest can be expected. Well, that is an absolute enshrined thing in the Second Amendment, isn't it? I mean, the Second Amendment, correct me if I'm wrong, I'm not brilliant on American history, but it's specifically about setting up militias to defend yourself from an overreaching government, isn't it? That, I mean, that is what is happening.
Yeah, well,
and that is, it seems to me that more and more Trump is kind of going complete opposition to the sort of traditional Republican ideas, a lot of traditional American ideas like that. He seems to have lost, as you were saying, his appeal was supposedly that he spoke directly to a base that kind of he really got their concerns and things. He seems to have lost that now completely.
I think there will be still some people who are in information environments where they're just not hearing any of that. But if you look at his headline poll numbers on this, it's clear that quite a big chunk of America actually doesn't like what ICE and the Border Patrol are doing. So I wouldn't, you know, I do think it is genuinely really concerning because, Ian, exactly as you were saying, there is a deliberate level of provocation here, going out and getting, never de-escalating, getting into these very difficult and dangerous situations. And then as soon as, you know, in this case, it looks to be like a complete cock-up of miscommunication and then extremely trigger-happy, badly trained, clearly panicked agents, again, like Rene Goode, just start firing. And in this case, firing. And you know, but that is sort of what's going to happen if you put people out into do deliberately aggressive in-your-face immigration enforcement.
And you tell them they've got impunity.
Yeah, and you say it's like, Trump's always going on about that film The Purge, you know, just about the idea that what if you just had a time where some, like, tough men were just allowed to do exactly what they wanted.
Yeah. And presumably at some stage this counters any appreciation of the American military. And I think that's why he got into trouble by saying that NATO forces had not stepped up to the mark and hadn't been on the front line and essentially said everyone else was cowardly. Because that's not what the American military thought. That's not what anyone else in NATO thought. And it suggested that tradition of a sort of vaguely supervised and legal entity, i.e. an army, was better than a group of people in masks going around shooting your own citizens. And I think that, again, is somewhere where he's gone wrong. And the fact that he climbed down on that, I thought, was partly due to reaction in America.
But again, it's one of those things that's an absolutely quintessential American value, is respect for veterans, isn't it?
Yeah, but he already blew through that. Remember he said the people in the cemetery at Arlington were suckers and losers. Mm. Why would anyone go and die for their country? Like, what's in it for you?
And John McCain as well.
I like people who aren't captured. Yeah. He said about a guy who couldn't raise his arms above his head because he'd been tortured so badly in Vietnam.
And it's coming from a man who dodged the draft 5 times for Vietnam himself, didn't he?
That's the thing. I felt, actually, one of the emotions I felt looking at the kind of MAGA commentators trying to defend it was I just felt profound embarrassment on their behalf. Just the kind of, you know what I mean? They clearly can't feel shame, so it's good that someone's feeling it on their behalf. But every day they're forced into these new mad contortions.
It's very comical alley for those with long memories, isn't it?
Very comical alley.
Yeah.
But at least he was getting paid.
The speech last week at Davos where he said Iceland 3 times when he was referring to Greenland.
Caroline Leavitt, the White House, said.
Just said, no, he didn't.
Well, she said, actually, he was talking about Greenland, which is a land of ice. Right, okay, yeah, sure.
Another masterstroke.
He said, I still said Iceland 3 times. It's there on the video. But it's just this extraordinary thing. Now you can just say, no, it isn't. No. No.
We'll have to wait and see how the Board of Peace plays out, of course. Can anyone think of another wise council, maybe a group of sort of informed individuals who might be able to solve the world's problems better than the Board of Peace?
Are we talking about the Jedi High Council?
Yep.
Yes, I noticed that as soon as I go on holiday, a lookalike appears in the magazine of this very scene, in which I appear to have been cast as Yoda.
One of us got to be Samuel L. Jackson. So I wonder if anyone can work out who was editing the letters page last week in his absence.
I have to say, the letter from the supposed reader, a Mr. Madam McQueen, was entirely unconvincing.
It was genuinely based on a comment on this very podcast YouTube channel. So
Can I just say that Madam McQueen should be your drag name? Phenomenal drag name.
Let's do the 60-second savings challenge. Step 1, download Rocket Money. Step 2, link your accounts, and see every subscription you're paying for. Tap one you don't use and cancel it. That's money back every month. Step 3. Create a financial goal. $50 every paycheck. Or let the app automatically move small amounts of cash when you can afford it. In a week, you'll forget you set it up. In a month, you'll see real dollars piling up. In a year, you'll be shocked at how much money you've saved. Bonus challenge. Upload an internet or phone bill and let Rocket Money try to lower it. You only pay if they find you savings. On average, Rocket Money members can save up to $740 a year when using all of the app's premium features. Users love the app with over 186,000 five-star ratings. Make saving money the resolution you actually keep. Start the 60-second savings challenge at rocketmoney.com/cancel. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
There's been a really interesting story in The Eye, this latest issue of The Eye, all about the fact that Times journalists are going to face some compulsory retraining coming up very soon. They're going to be expected to attend in person at least one quite lengthy session about the proper use of AI. And this is off the back of some really, really funny things which happened at The Times last year. Firstly, they ran a lengthy interview with a cleaner at Buckingham Palace, a lady called Anne Simmons, who'd been there many years and had lots of interesting things to say, who it turned out did not exist. She had been, I think, fabricated by a tile company in a press release. And so she was an AI person. And secondly, there was
She was, I should say, photographed as well. There was a photograph along with the interview.
Of who?
Of this non-existent person.
An AI-generated image of the AI person.
Yeah, a woman who looked a bit like she might have been a cleaner at Buckingham Palace sitting on a very nice sofa.
And the other one was slightly better known. It was the Bill de Blasio story, which I would say is not really an AI screw-up. There was a hack who was asked to get some quotes from the former mayor of New York, Bill de Blasio, and wrote to the wrong Bill de Blasio. Got the wrong email address and wrote to a wine merchant from Long Island who then used ChatGPT to come up with a load of quotes which were sent back to the Times and then printed. I don't know how.
Has that
AI
ever happened to you and the other Andy Murray?
No, it hasn't.
You should start pitch for more business.
I would like that. Andy Burnham's name, his middle name is Murray. He's technically fully known as Andrew Murray Burnham. What's going on there?
You're everywhere.
Oh, yeah. Anyway, so the Times are doing this. They're trying to use AI more effectively, or at least not get gulled by AI stories. And it's a very, very interesting facet of the AI story, because it turns out journalists are not automatically better at spotting AI slop and fabrications than the rest of us.
And particularly if there aren't many of them and they don't have much time.
Yes.
Which presumably, I mean, the answer to most of the things is hire some human beings, isn't it?
Pretty much. But this is a growing problem. And in preparation for this sort of discussion of like how AI is affecting the media, I listened back to the chat from a couple of years ago when we had Matt Muir on, talking then about what this amazing new thing called ChatGPT was and any risks and opportunities it might present. And basically everything's got worse since then. Hey. Is the shortcut
Some
answer.
Of the reason why it's got worse is that it's got better. I mean, the AI is improving hugely all the time, so things are a lot more convincing. I mean, you can now generate photos of supposed Buckingham Palace cleaners who don't have seven fingers on each hand or stuff like that. So it is getting more difficult to spot this stuff, definitely. But that is certainly being taken advantage of, isn't it? Have you seen the Press Gazette investigation into this?
Yeah.
Go on.
You say it.
So Press Gazette have got Rob Waugh, who's a long-standing tech journalist, does a lot of stuff for the Daily Mail, also writes a lot of their kind of like, woo, UFOs and witchcraft kind of stories for the Daily Mail, all that woo-woo stuff. So he featured in the Hack Watch recently. But a good journalist, nonetheless, who is compiling a list for Press Gazette, which is kind of a trade mag for journalists. He came up with 50 apparently fake experts, which doesn't sound that impressive, but 50 apparently fake experts whose comments have been quoted more than 1,000 times in the media in recent years. So these are completely people that there is no evidence that they actually exist, but who've been provided to journalists on various kind of websites and local papers as well as national papers, with sort of case studies of, you know, this happened to me, or supposedly, you know, they're academics, nutritionists, that kind of thing, who've got advice for people, none of whom appear to actually exist. And obviously, if you are a massively overworked journalist on a local website and you've got to churn out 30, 40, 100 stories every day, and you're handed a press release which has, you know, a case study in it with someone, maybe even a nice photo of them that you can use, then you're not going to have the time to phone them up and check yourself that they've got that your first question will be, do you actually exist?
Yeah.
The thing I think is very worrying is that the guardrails have kind of come off, and not just in the media, but in a number of different places. So one of the things that the West Midlands police chief had to admit was that his report on Tel Aviv Maccabee and their fans included an invented match, essentially, which they were deemed to have been hooligans. That was an AI hallucination. The Trump administration is all the time pumping out fake AI bollocks on Twitter and X. You know, you just cannot now trust a government handout photo not to have been altered.
Yeah.
I think that I always think the metaphor for it is a bit like kind of essentially like there's been pollution in the information stream, right? And it's very hard to get that out once it's in there.
Mm. Yes, there was a report last year about the potential. I think it's a problem. It's not clear yet that it's a disastrous problem for, let's say, the Russian government to, as it were, go upstream, fill the web with slop text, pushing Pravda talking points, and then wait for those to be picked up by AI crawlers, bots that look around the web searching for new material to harvest. I think it's not a disastrous problem because they are trying to work out which sources are most trustworthy and to prioritise those. But it can still definitely be a problem.
Well, the Russian government's also just doing some really old-fashioned stuff. If you remember the year before last, they just turned out to have been paying a load of American culture war influencers like Tim Pool and Dave Rubin through an intermediary.
Yes.
And in order just basically, because what Russia wants is just people pumping out most divisive possible cultural content in America. And they all said, we had no idea that this extremely, you know, attractive woman with a very thin CV, again, probably AI-generated CV that they took the money and didn't look into. That's the problem. The cost of generating bullshit is now essentially zero. Mm. And all that was stopping people from filling the information sphere with bullshit before was the fact it was just too much work. Mm. And now it isn't very much work at all.
Whereas the cost of getting journalists to check that things aren't bullshit is now prohibitive for an awful lot of news organisations.
Right. But this is the third phase. I mean, this is McQueen's law of journalism. He started off trying to break stories, then he spent the second half of his career trying to say these stories aren't true. Phase three seems to be no one cares, Adam. There are too many of them. Get a life.
Well, I'll give you some numbers because I find this really interesting. So the number of adults in the UK who say they've used tools like ChatGPT and Google Gemini to better understand current events. Any guesses?
30%?
47. Mm. Yeah. Quite high. In terms of people in senior jobs in the UK, sort of senior management positions, it's 81.
So wow.
It's much higher. However, there are questions of trust over it still. So when surveyed, 4% of people said that they thought AI summaries were the most trustworthy source. That compares with 44% saying a news website is the most trustworthy source. So a factor of 10 difference. And that there is still a lot more trust associated with news websites.
I went to see Jimmy Wales give a speech, the founder of Wikipedia, who said, and he's very impressive nowadays, he said, you know, when we started, we were a joke. Now we're a standard of extraordinary authority in terms of fact. And his basic pitch is, I have human beings still as moderators, and a consensus of diligent and altruistic human beings. And he says there still are some. They're not working, obviously, for the other tech pros, but they are working for him, create a version of truth which is much nearer to truth than the massed forces of everyone else. So I think it is still possible, and that is still part of the job, is to say this stuff is not nearly good enough.
We should, again, put the slightly positive case. AI is very useful for things like data journalism. You know, it is very good at crunching together large amounts of information if you are well trained on it and you know what you're trying to pull out of it. You know, there are lots of positive uses, and lots of media organisations are trying to use it effectively now. Now, normally Private Eye covers the cases where people are not using it effectively, like Reach. Which I don't know if it's you who's been writing the stories about them.
Quite a lot of them, yeah. Well, I mean, that is the other side of it, is the use of AI by the media as well. I mean, Reach have been absolutely open about using this tool that they slightly depressingly call Guten, after Gutenberg, the inventor of the printing press, which allows them to do multiple versions of what is effectively the same story and then pump them out across their network of websites across the UK. The most effective journalist at this, I have to say, is a guy called James Rodger.
Is he real?
So it's my rule again that you should never trust a man with two first names. Andrew Hunter Murray.
Oh, dear.
He's on Birmingham Live. He has been known to churn out up to 100 pieces under his byline every single day. I had a look this morning as we're recording. Just from today, we've got Met Office names all of the 27 areas facing 17 hours of snow on Tuesday. That was at 10:52. Met Office names all the UK areas set to escape snow on Tuesday. Full list, 10:57. All of the Midlands towns set for 17 hours of snow on Tuesday. Full list, 11:01. UK snow bomb brought forward to new date as West Midlands verdict confirmed, 11:28. Met Office names all of the UK areas who have to pack emergency kit before Tuesday. Full list. Spoiler alert on that one. You don't have to pack an emergency kit.
But the thing that's interesting when you read out all of those headlines is those headlines are written for Google, like jam full of SEO, 100%. Search engine keywords. So you've essentially got robots writing copy for robots, for other robots.
With a brief intermediary of a human having to... The human's the thin paste in the middle of the sandwich.
Right. But the other thing is that most news organisations are preparing for Google Search to deliver them no traffic by the end of this year.
Yeah.
Because Google now puts in the Google Gemini AI thing. So, you know, there's always been this tension with, you know, in Australia there's been cases about Google News paying journalists because essentially it's like using, harvesting their content and putting their headlines. Now the thing is that Google will now just, you know, essentially has just cut off that spigot of directing anybody to news websites. It would rather them just see a little panel at the top of their Google result.
And this is where you get the argument about what media organisations should do about that. So there is a case that I've seen made that, for example, rather than The Guardian striking a deal with OpenAI so that OpenAI can inhale all The Guardian's archive, which, you know, good, well-sourced stuff, few typos, no problem. But basically, OpenAI is getting a huge new source of decent news in exchange for a financial deal with OpenAI. That is a way that the power is handed to OpenAI. You know, the consumer is getting their news from OpenAI. It happens to come originally from The Guardian. What if, instead of that, let's say the BBC or whoever had their own AI engine, which can produce results based on everything the BBC has produced over the last 100-odd years. Mm. You know, that's a way that AI could be used to deliver trustworthy, reliable results to people who want to know what they're getting.
Well, yes. I think more people are going to do essentially a version of the like long-standing private eye gambit, right? Which is you can only consume our content on our source. You know, we're like, we call it the magazine. But now like lots of people are, you know, are saying, come to our app, you know, trying to keep you on their particular platform. And the other thing that delivers an absolute boatload of traffic is Apple News, which is essentially what everybody's been trying to make work forever, which is the micropayment system, right? You pay a flat fee and then you get access to loads and loads of places. But I think there is a real divergence between people who've decided to go kind of, we're worth paying for and you're going to have to pay for us. And like you say, the reaches of the world who've gone, pile them high, sell them cheap.
Let's not make anything worth paying for.
Yeah. And let's run this business down until, you know, until it goes under because there's just not enough money left in it anymore.
But I did read a very, very good analysis of the trajectory of nearly all organisations, and AI is following them in that... It's not making any money. No one's making any money. It costs far too much money to do videos. There aren't enough deserts full of data centres being sprayed by empty reservoirs to actually finance this. So what do? There are two ways out. The first way is advertising, which they said they wouldn't do, which they're now considering. Right. And the second way is porn, which, again, this was meant to be AI. It was meant to be sort of for the good of humankind and all those really reliable tech bros sitting around telling each other they were doing this for the public good. The public good seems to be taking money from other commercial enterprises and running porn. Mm. So that's a positive future.
Progress, yeah.
It's work for Elon Musk.
That's a suitably depressing note to end on.
Yes, sorry about that.
No.
You tried to be upbeat for a brief flicker of time.
I know. That's it for this episode of Page 94. Thank you so much for listening. If you would like to get hold of proper human-produced journalism, it's available in the magazine. It's available on newsstands, and it's available at private-i.co.uk. There are subscriptions available for very reasonable prices. We'll be back again in a fortnight with another of these. Until then, there's only time to say thank you once again for listening, and thank you to Matt Hill of Rethink Audio for producing. Bye for now.